Well, good day and welcome back to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back this week with part two of our special two-part episode from the response at Hurricane Matthew. Our frequent guest and one of our sponsors, Dr. Joe Holly from the Paragon Medical Education Group, his USAR team was deployed to the coast of North Carolina to respond to the major flooding there and the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. And if you didn't pick up the first part of this episode, you'll want to head back and check that out last week. But this is part two of that episode where we dig into some of the operational challenges he and the other teams faced while responding to this event. Check it out in this second part of that two-part episode coming up right now.
So, Joe, let's switch gears a little bit. Can we talk about the field operation and what the teams are actually out there doing and the kind of rescue situations they ran into?
Absolutely. I think once the, as is often the case with these things, it takes a little time for the situation to develop. And, I think we saw most of our activity and action in North Carolina, mostly related to the massive amount of flooding after they got, 12 inches of rain or something. There were a lot of issues around that. It was quite interesting. North Carolina obviously is a state with a lot of agricultural industries there, and I got very educated on the amount of pig, cow, and chicken waste that can be produced. And obviously most of these major producers of that stuff collected in these big lagoons to use it for fertilizer and all kinds of stuff, and many of those lagoons got overtopped as the floodwaters came up, which obviously added to the very pleasant nature of the water there. But those were huge issues for our teams to make certain they didn't inadvertently wander into one of those places. So that was part of what we were doing. It was initially some overflights utilizing Coast Guard and local helicopter assets to sort of figure out what areas were being affected. Once it was obvious that there was some pretty substantial flooding going on, we got tasked with some waterborne search and rescue to go through neighborhoods that were underwater and clear the structures to make sure nobody was in there. That included pets as well as people, and that I think turned out to be probably the primary amount of work that we did on this one was had an awful lot to do with the search and rescue component in areas that were inundated by water. We had a lot of other things going on from concerns about a fairly large regional hospital system that was pretty severely impacted, was running on generators, and trying to figure out their capabilities, which changed very frequently as one generator went offline, another one was brought on, and the Carolinas sent their mobile emergency department intensive care unit down there, which is kind of a big ICU in a truck, and set up in the parking lot and was able to offload some of their intensive care patients out of the hospital and into there. I got a couple of phone calls from FEMA headquarters in D.C. saying, we heard a report that their generator just blew up and the entire hospital is evacuating. Can you go over there and see what's really going on? And, you get over there and start talking to people and you find out, well, yeah, one generator did go offline, but we got three others and we're actually doing okay. And yes, we went ahead and evacuated some of our intensive care patients because we were just concerned that we wouldn't have enough power to maintain everything. So we decided to go ahead and, offload all that. So as is often the case, the real story is somewhere between the the hype that gets passed on. And that's part of what our job is to kind of figure out what's the real story here. The other part of the job has to do with the medical care of the team. And obviously any victims or survivors that we pull out of those situations. So each team has its own physician that is there to help take care of the team. My job is to kind of coordinate all those physicians and do things like, if we hear one team has been to a certain area and is having some sort of issue related to that, I'll just, some kind of weird skin rash or some sort of respiratory or GI illness, then, part of what I'm doing is trying to figure out where were they? Is this likely to be related to the water that they were just in? Making certain that other teams are aware, hey, that other team was over there and they had some problems. You guys might want to be extra careful in that area, or just watching for any sort of unusual outbreak related to the exposures that the teams may have gotten while they were out and operational. I think at the end of the day, at the end of our deployment, we were over 500 confirmed rescues of people, and I don't know the number of domestic animals that we were involved with, but they were a lot. I would certainly say in the hundreds probably. So, we actually have two veterinarians that work with us who help take care of the veterinary side of things and are part of our subject matter experts on, how concerned do we need to be about this entire chicken house that got flooded, and what kind of issues could be around that as we're working in that area. There's a constant need to update the medical intelligence component for the teams as hospitals, come back online or have an issue where there's a shortage of something. For example, the one hospital that we were dealing with, the big hospital that we were dealing with in North Carolina, had, because their laboratory was not functional due to their power issues, they were using iStat machines to, do blood analysis on patients in the ER that showed up. And those are really, great sort of portable laboratory blood analyzer tools that, can run off battery and generator power and all that sort of stuff, and they're portable. But to use them, you have to have these little small cartridges that are about the size of an SD card, and you put a sample of the patient's blood on this card, and then you insert the machine, and it runs a series of tests. And they were down to about 70 of those cartridges, meaning they were almost, about to lose their capability of being able to run blood tests on patients. And so, we spent some time trying to figure out if the machines they were using were the same ones that we were using that we carry, and could we give them some of our cartridges and that sort of stuff, or could we find another source to help resupply them to keep their capabilities up. So, it's a lot of time spent doing odd things like that that are all just trying to get the system back online. We collect a lot of information from all the task forces back to the incident support team on sort of every level. So it's things like, the number of rescues, the locations that we've searched and can confirm, have been cleared. And we collect information daily on the medical condition of the team. What kind of issues are people having? What kind of problems are they having? What sort of issues are they seeing out in the field? We gather all that for the different teams, collate all that together, and then use that as part of our decision-making tool.
Joe, I hear you talking about just the logistical challenges, which we keep coming back to that, but it reminds me of one of the stories we had from Hurricane Katrina with one of our guests who talked about how they kept a notebook and said, you know, I had the name of this person who had this resource and I kept that in there. And then I later on heard about somebody who had, you know, A, B, or C resource, and here's somebody with D, E, and F resource, and we put them together because somebody else came in with the need. It sounds like you had a whole lot of that, you know, just talking about the iStat cartridges and things like that, where you had to take somebody's need and find the available resources that could fulfill that need.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. That is a huge part of the job. You know, I carry around a waterproof notebook in my pocket that I just gets filled up day after day with the contacts that I made, the people I've talked to, phone numbers, information that I need to pass on, et cetera. It is a lot of sort of networking on many different levels as part of our service to that community that's impacted. You know, we may can reach out someplace that they don't know to reach out to get them connected with somebody that can supply something that they need. Or because we've been on the move and our communication system might be working better than theirs at the time, we can reach out and say, hey, there's a need down here, or there's a supply of, you know, fill in the blank at this other location. So it always is a lot about keeping up with what people need and what people can do, and then in many cases kind of going back and connecting those two things together.
You know, I was thinking, Joe, we could probably do a whole podcast just on the clinical implications of all of the different waterborne problems that are created. You mentioned a few of them. BJ, that was a really big issue after Katrina, right?
Oh, definitely. You had issues with all the healthcare workers that were going in and out of the water that, just like Joe said, you know, you're concerned with things like animal byproducts. We had issues with who knows what somebody had in their garage, gallons of this, that, or what other dangerous chemical was around. So you had odd rashes and illnesses coming up just from exposure, and it was very hard to narrow those kind of things down.
You know, Joe, I was wondering too, you've dealt with a number of different states. How did you, was it kind of seamless, or did you find the disaster preparedness process different from state to state?
Oh, you know, there's definitely quite a bit of variability from state to state. Part of what, you know, the FEMA region tries to do is to reach across all those states in their region and, you know, make it a more seamless process. But, you know, some states are simply better prepared than others. Some communities are better prepared than others. We had contact with a couple of sort of local emergency operations centers who, when we were asking about concerns over hazardous materials and you know, petroleum storage and all kinds of things that are on our radar screen, you know, they were like, no, it's all, everything's fine, we're good. Yet we knew that there were a whole lot of issues out there that they clearly weren't aware of, or weren't bothered by. And I think part of our job is to also try to educate folks. Again, we're lucky enough to have a lot of experience doing this, and to try to share that experience with folks who are often, you know, brand new in these positions. I remember several emergency managers who were very, very young and, you know, sort of remembered Hurricane Floyd when they were 6 years old. And, you know, the damage that Hurricane Floyd did in the Carolinas was pretty substantial. And yet these folks were, you know, young children. And since that time, really not much has happened. So for them, it's a challenge to appreciate the scope and the complexities of one of these impacts that just touches on everything from your ability to take care of patients on the south side of town who are completely isolated by a flooded river from their only source of medical care, which is on the north side of town. And how are you going to get there, and how are you going to get people to them, and how are you going to get them out of there? An awful lot of variability at every level, from state level government right down to, you know, the most local guy out there.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because, you know, as much as we don't want to throw this kind of thing on anybody, that's what they're there to do. So maybe these young disaster preparedness people now having a bit of a trial by fire are going to be that much better when something else rolls around. And I got a question for you, Joe, and this may be apples and oranges, but, you know, there's two distinct different jobs that you do. One is the physician with your team, and the other was your more of your 10,000-foot view as a physician on the IST. Which of those things do you find the most challenging? Which of those things do you find most enjoyment in?
Oh, I absolutely love them both. I think the when you're out with the team, you oftentimes have more opportunity for the operations side of that, where you're, you know, actually got boats in the water and you're out doing your thing. When you're on the incident support team side, the perspective is a little bit larger area, but I think also allows me to get into contact and be on site in lots of different areas that some teams don't have. I'd like to say sometimes I have a little bit of insight as to what's coming and what direction things are going in. Oftentimes I'm in the dark as much as the teams are, because we don't know any of that stuff until it pops up at the last minute. And, you know, suddenly there's a request for us, you know, 50 or 100 miles away, and we got to load the team up and we got to get going. And, we got to get out ahead of that and have the infrastructure in place for when the team gets there. You know, it's a big deal to move three tractor trailers and three box trucks and, multiple utility vehicles and two buses full of people. You can't just, you know, tell them to drive to town and figure out a place to go. You gotta find a location for them. You gotta have services for them. You gotta have the ability to feed them. People got to know that they're there and all that sort of stuff. So at the incident support team level, you know, we push out ahead of the teams trying to have all that stuff in place by the time they're there so that they're ready to go to work when we get there. So, you know, the short answer is I love them both. They both have their frustrations and they both have their fun to them. I love being out in the field, and it's where I feel most at home and where I feel like I have the biggest impact. But it's the same thing, only a little different, and maybe with just a different priorities and duties to some extent.
So you, as the USAR doc, next time you're out with your team, you'll have a much better appreciation of those guys up in the IST that are taking care of business for you. So we're probably getting ready to wind down here. BJ, you got any last questions for Joe?
I actually do. It's going to seem a little odd to you, Joe, but here as an after action, how do you or your team determine your, pardon me, your success? How do y'all look back at an incident and say that was a success for the team? I'm not, obviously, you know, bad things happen. There's all kind of issues. But a lot of us have to look back at our own level of skill and how we do it. So how does a team like this determine that it was successful, and how do you pinpoint where do you need to improve?
Oh, I think that's a phenomenal question. And I think that sort of works on a lot of different levels. We have a formal after action report that everyone on the team is required to submit, talking about things that went well and things that didn't go well. I think we look at our quality and to some extent of our work as what kind of feedback do we get from emergency operations centers and the folks that we worked with. Obviously, the sort of numbers of people that we impacted from, you know, a rescue standpoint, et cetera, is an easy one to look at. And you know, when you got 500 people that you rescued, you feel pretty good about what you did. But I think we're fairly self-critical, realizing that all of these things are chaotic and take a while to get going, and that they are you're virtually guaranteed to never meet everyone's expectations, because they all, you know, want it all fixed right away, and that's not really possible. So some of that setting expectations and then measuring yourself against those expectations.
Kevin, any last thoughts?
No, I'm just kind of taking it all in, and good job by everybody involved. And it would have been cool to have the on-site kind of catch up, but I understand how, you know, it's called the disaster for a reason, and Murphy's Law comes into play, obviously, about the Skype not working and you know, all the last-minute things that affect that. But overall, glad you're back safe, glad everybody on Teams is safe, and no major catastrophes on the rest of this park. And, yeah.
And, Joe, I just have to say, you know, people don't know how busy you are. You're an ER doc. You're engaged with USAR. You have your own business, which is Paragon Medical Education. And I have to laugh. I mean, I love Jim, because he kept, as we were kind of knew you were going to be deployed, he kept running up and giving us little updates on what was going on. I think he was a little jealous because, you know, you were off on a new adventure. But we do appreciate everything you do. If people only had any idea how valuable you were. I just had to say that. So, Jamie?
Well, I just want to, you know, just kind of bring it back to talking to Joe a little bit about, you know, how training figured into this. Obviously, you guys train a lot. I know Paragon Medical Education Group does a lot to help organizations prepare for different types of disaster responses in their communities. Can you just briefly just talk a little bit about how you think training figured into this particular response?
Oh, I think there's no question that, you know, the training on the part of the teams makes us able to go out and do what we do on pretty short notice and do it safely and do it quite efficiently, considering the scope of many of these things that we get involved with. But I think, you know, the other side of that coin is a comparison between emergency operations folks who clearly are quite competent at what they're doing, and others who really struggle to understand what it is that they're trying to accomplish and how it's supposed to work, and the things that need to be done and why they need to be done. You know, you really, incidents like this really sort of bring out the weak links in the chain. And I think that's, you know, from my standpoint, that's the folks that we really want to try to engage with, so that we can help them understand better the things that need to be done and how they need to be done, and try to bring them up to a level where they're expertise is as high as we can get it, whether that's, you know, on an actual deployment or whether that's through a training opportunity that Paragon might offer to them.
And it's important for people to know that you offer that training at all levels. So you have training for the responders that are out there on the street, but you also are including in that training, training for the upper echelon, the people that are having to maintain that 10,000 foot view for their communities and coordinate a bunch of resources. And you put it all together in such a neat way that I think that people would really serve their communities very well to look into what Paragon offers and talk about to finding ways to bring you in. Where can they reach out to you to look into how you can come into their community?
Well, probably the easiest place to find us is obviously through the Disaster Podcast, but our website is paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can find us on Facebook under the same name. We have a Twitter feed, Paragon Med EDU. Hopefully we'll try to get some pictures up from the latest adventure out there. But those standard social media and web outlets are the best place to get to us.
And we'll make sure we have links to that. And, of course, there's always a link to Paragon's site right in the right-hand side of the disasterpodcast.com site. So people can head over there. Thank you guys for your continued support of our show and helping to bring this information out to our community here on the podcast. Kevin, where can folks find you?
People can find me at wildsafety.com, and all links to various social media is there. And I'm also trying to get more active in the Facebook group. And I'm always hanging around watching, keeping an eye on the Disaster Podcast website.
Excellent. And BJ, how about you?
You can always find me at zifosbooks.net. That's zifosbooks.net. Or at Zephos Books on Facebook as well. Happy to talk to people anytime.
Cool. And we've been talking, you and Sam and I, about the possibility you guys might be putting together a first responders books podcast so that people can hear authors in the first responders space talk about their projects, so where they are putting books out, and that's pretty cool. So we'll be
we're on the 10-yard line, charging for the end zone now. I think that's gonna be a really positive.
It's coming soon, so we're hoping to have that together maybe in the next couple of weeks, and we'll talk about that here maybe for a little bit on the podcast. Sam, how about you?
Well, you usually find me in the social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And, you know, Joe, in your spare time, we need to get you to write a book so we can interview you on the First Responder Author Podcast. I know you're working on that in your spare time. But
I have spare time currently. That's part of the problem.
But we'd love for you to come over to the site. I could do another hour with all the questions I have in my head on Joe's adventure. So I hope you have some questions out there, and I'm sure Joe would come up and answer them for you if you want a little more information on USAR or what he does. So please ask, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything else that you might want to talk about or some guests that you might recommend to us. Hey, Jamie?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, we've talked a lot about the U.S. response. Something we haven't touched on, and we may want to look into coming up later on, is to talk a little bit about what's going on in the Caribbean, because Hurricane Matthew just devastated parts of Haiti, parts of the Bahamas, and direct strikes to those communities. And because the U.S. had involvement here on the mainland, we haven't heard too much about what's going on down there. And I'm sure there's some things going on. So we'll have to follow up on that in a future episode. I think there's a lot to cover from this single weather event. As far as me, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media sites, and of course over at disasterpodcast.com. So leave a comment or a question over there for Joe and the rest of the team, and we'll make sure we respond back to you. Also, look us up on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. You just have to request to join, but we'll certainly accept you. And there's a great way to communicate with other members of the audience over there, talk back and forth about episodes that are posted, and it really is a great way to keep in touch with each other and form a little bit of a community here for the Disaster Podcast folks. But Sam, Joe ran into a lot of stuff out there, and we've talked a lot about having an actual deployment for one of our team. And here we go. We have one, and it turned out to be quite a doozy.
It was, and I was rather surprised that my DMAT didn't end up getting deployed, but that was probably because they were at the other end of the state. And I know they were very bummed that they didn't end up going. So, but we thank Joe and his USAR. Maybe one of these days we'll have a DMAT podcast, because I may become deployed. So we'll have to see. But, I don't think there's a clearer example, Jamie, of what we've always talked about in these podcasts, that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.